Chapter 8. Zerash. That hope is little more than the premonition of regret. This is the first lesson of history. Cocytus, the Annals of Cannae. To merely recall the apocalypse is to have survived it. This is what makes the sagas, for all their cramped beauty, so monstrous. Despite their protestations, the poets who authored them do not tremble, even less do they grieve. They celebrate. Drusus Acamian, The Compendium of the First Holy War. Early Spring, 4112, Year of the Tusk, Zerash. At the bidding of the warrior prophet, the disparate elements of the Holy War began to converge on Garotha. Using the Herodic Way, Lord Soter and his Kishyati were the first to spy the city's black curtain walls. The imperious Ainani Palatine rode directly to the gate that the men of the Tusk would come to call the Twin Fists and demanded to parley with the Sapatashah governor. The Zerashi told him that it was only fear of atrocity that moved them to bar their gates. Lord Soter laughed at that, and without further word, withdrew to the cultivated plain surrounding the city. He struck the first camp of the siege in the middle of a trampled sugarcane field. The warrior prophet, along with Proyas and Gotian, arrived early the following day. By evening, the Garothans had sent an embassy, as much simply to see the false prophet who had struck down the Padiraja as to barter with him. They had no heart for hard bargains. Apparently, the Sapatashah of Zerash, Utgarangi, and all the surviving Kianin had evacuated the city days previously. Hours later, the embassy returned to the Twin Fists, convinced they had no choice but to surrender, and to do so without condition. After a long, forced march, Gothyelk and the bulk of the Tidoni arrived during the night. The following morning found the men of the Garothan embassy strung from the battlements of the Great Gate, their entrails sagging to the foundations. According to defectors who managed to escape the city, there had been a coup that night, led by priests and officers loyal to their old Kianin overlords. The men of the Tusk began preparing their assault. When the warrior prophet rode to the Twin Fists to demand an explanation, he was greeted by an old veteran calling himself Captain Heberata. With a vitriol only the old can summon, the man cursed the warrior prophet as false and threatened the solitary god's retribution as though it were merely another coin in his purse. Then, at the end of his tirade, someone fired a crossbow bolt. The warrior prophet snatched it from the air just short of his neck. To the wonder of all, he raised the missile aloft. "Hear this, Heberata," he cried. "From this day, I count." A cryptic statement that troubled even the Enrithi. During this time, Coithus Athgieri ranged ever eastward with his hardened Gainry knights. They blundered into their first Kianin patrols south of a town called Nebethra. After a sharp melee, the Kianin broke and fled toward Cargido. Interrogating the survivors, the Galeoth Earl learned that Fenile himself was in Shima, though none knew whether he planned to remain there. The Kianin claimed to have been sent out to gather intelligence on sites the Enrithi thought holy. According to one of the captives, the Padiraja hoped that securing and despoiling these places would provoke the false prophet to acts of stupidity. This deeply alarmed the pious young earl. That night, he held a council with his captains, where it was decided that if any man should be provoked to rashness, it should be Coithus Athgieri. Using copies of antique Nansur maps, they staked out a route from holy place to holy place. After kneeling for the temple prayer, they joined their mailed kinsmen about the bonfires. Their Umarnan and Mongolian chargers were led out of the darkness, and they mounted with a myriad of shouts. Then wordlessly, they rode into the moonlit hills. So began what came to be called Athgieri's pilgrimage. He rode first to survey Cargido on the footings of the Betmula. Since entering Zerash, the men of the Tusk had heard much of this ancient fortress, and the warrior prophet had bid Athgieri send him a report. After dispatching messengers with sketches and estimates, he struck through the foothills, twice surprising and scattering Kianin under the banner of Kinganjahoy. They found the hilltop village and shrine of Musala, where the latter prophet had returned to Horam on his site, a smoking ruin. Upon that ground, they swore a mighty oath. In the meantime, all but the last elements of the holy war joined their brothers outside the walls of Garotha. The fact that the Zarashi made no sorties attested to their weakness, and in the council of great and lesser names, both Holwarga and Gothyelk pressed for an immediate assault. But the warrior prophet chided them, saying that the nearness of their destination and not their confidence motivated their anxiousness to attack. "Where hopes burn bright," he said, "patience is quickly consumed." "They need only wait," he explained, "and the city would fall of its own accord." Music. This was the first thing Esmanet heard the day she began reading the sagas. She hovered in that moment of consciousness that immediately follows awakening, a kind of twilight of thought, bereft of self or place, yet painfully alert. And there was music. She smiled in groggy recognition, the finger drumming, the punctuated bow strokes, bold and dramatic. It was Kianin music, she realized, being played somewhere within the many-chambered umbilica. "Yes, yes," a muffled voice called as the performance continued. She listened carefully, hoping to discern his voice somewhere beneath the music and above the ambient rumble of the stirring encampment. He always spoke between sounds, it seemed. The song faltered, only to be drowned by the sound of laughter and sporadic clapping. It was the morning of their fourth day encamped about Garotha and her stubborn walls. After vomiting, she struggled with her breakfast while her body slaves fussed over her attire. With Yell and Burulan rolling their eyes, Fanashila explained the earlier music in her broken but improving Shaik. Apparently, three Zarashi captives, enslaved as porters, had petitioned Geyamakri for an opportunity to demonstrate their musical skills. What was more, the girl continued, one of them was more handsome than even the Kanryan prince, or Poyas, as she called him. Yell had laughed aloud at that. After a moment's pause, Fanashila blurted, "Slave may marry slave, no, mistress?" Esmanet smiled, but because of a pang in her throat, she could do no more than nod. Afterward, she weathered Opsara's glare as she visited Moengus. As always, she marveled at the way he seemed to grow from morning to morning, even as she avoided looking too long into his turquoise eyes. Their color was not changing. She thought of Serwe, cursed herself for not missing the girl. Then she thought of the spark that burned within her own womb. After learning the latest details of the siege from Captain Heorsa, she joined Werjau for the summary of reports. Everything seemed deceptively routine, from the kinds of incidents reported to the continuing challenges of maintaining a network of contacts and informants in an army on the march. They had all learned to stand on marbles by now, but every day it seemed someone disappeared and someone else reemerged. Aside from the Zarashi musicians, the only matter of concern regarded Lord Uranyanka and his Mozarothi clients. Though he'd publicly repented the massacres at Sabatha, he continued to rail against the warrior prophet in private. Uranyanka was an evil, black-hearted fool. More than once, Esmanet had counseled his arrest, but Kellis had deemed the Ainani Palatine too important, one of those who had to be mollified rather than admonished. Her duties as Intricati busied her long into the afternoon. She had grown accustomed to them enough to become bored, especially when it came to administrative matters. Sometimes her old eyes would overcome her, and she would find herself gauging the men about her with the carnal boredom of a whore sizing up custom. A sudden awareness of clothing and distance would descend upon her, and she would feel inviolate in a way that made her skin tingle. All the acts they could not commit, all the places they could not touch, these banned possibilities would seem to hang above her like the smoke hazing the canvas ceilings. "I am forbidden," she would think. Why this should make her feel so pure, she could not fathom. Late in the afternoon, she baffled Proyas by laughingly calling him Lord Poyas during an extended briefing on the latest intelligence coming in from the field. Her bouts of impish humor were lost on him, she realized, not only because he was Kunrayan and so suffered an over-elaborate sense of gallantry, but because he continued to grieve their earlier animosity. Their parting was awkward. Then, following an update from Werjiao regarding the Zarashi musicians, she somehow escaped the Nesenti and their endless requests and discovered that she had nothing to do. This was how she found her way to the sagas. She still thought of reading as practice, though she'd found it quite effortless for some time now. In fact, she not only hungered for opportunities to read, she often found herself simply staring at her humble collection of scrolls and codices, suffused with the same miserly feeling she harbored toward her cosmetics chest. But where the paints merely balmed the fears of her former self, the writings were something altogether different, something transformative rather than recuperative. It was as though the inked characters had become rungs on a ladder, or an endlessly uncoiling rope, something that allowed her to climb ever higher, to see ever more. "You've learned the lesson," Kellis had said on one of those rare mornings when he shared her breakfast. "What lesson might that be?" "That the lessons never end," he laughed, gingerly sipped his steaming tea. "That ignorance is infinite." "How," she asked, at once earnest and delighted, "can anyone presume to be certain?" Kella smiled in the devilish way she so adored. "They think they know me," he said. Esmanette had thrown a pillow at him for that, and it had seemed a thing of wonder, throwing a pillow at a prophet. She knelt before the ivory-paneled chest that contained her library, raised and pressed back the lid. As always, she savored the smell of oiled bindings. There were few books within. The Phanum of Karaskand had possessed little interest in idolatrous works, let alone Shaikh translations of them. Because none of her slaves could read, she'd been forced to pack the works herself, sifting through the shelves and scroll racks in what had been Akamian's room. She'd been reluctant to stow the sagas then, and now, spying the scrolls beneath Protathus, she felt that same reluctance. Scowling, she gathered them and carried them to her bed, wondering that the apocalypse could feel so light. She propped herself against her favorite barrel pillow. Then, running her fingers along the soon-to-be-unrolled parchment, she glimpsed the tattoo across the back of her left hand. It seemed a kind of charm or totem now, her version of an ancestor scroll. That woman, that Sumni harlot who had hung her legs bare from her window, was a stranger to her now. Blood joined them, perhaps, but little else. Her poverty, her smell, her degradation, her simplicity, everything seemed to argue against her. The trappings, let alone the facts of her power, would be enough to make the old Esmanette weep for wonder. Within the concentric scheme of Nesenti and judges that Kellis had grafted onto the old trial and cultic hierarchies, she, consort and intricati, occupied the second most powerful ring. Gaia Makri answered to her. Gotian answered to her, Werjiao, even potentates in their own right, men such as Proyas and Eleazarus, had to bow chin to chest. She had rewritten Janan, and this, Kellis had promised her, was but the beginning. Then there was the strength of her faith. The old Esmanette, the cynical harlot, would find this the most difficult to comprehend. Her world had been dark and capricious, a place where significance was apportioned only to those caught within some dread whimsy of the gods. The old her wouldn't fathom the indwelling awe that now accompanied her every heartbeat. If anything, her whorish hackles would rise, and in private moments, she would counsel doubt and suspicion. She had lain with too many priests. The old Esmanette would never accept an understanding indistinguishable from trust. And the pregnancy, the thought that she carried not merely a son, but a destiny within her womb, how she would laugh. But what would strike the old Esmanette the most, she had no doubt, would be the knowledge. In that one respect, she'd been extraordinary. Very few pondered their ignorance as she had. Their conceit compelled them to prize only what they knew beforehand. and since significance followed from the already known, they always thought they possessed everything relevant to any question of truth, obliviousness made obvious. She had always understood that her world, for all its grand immensity, was a sham. This was why she had made her custom into apertures, windows onto the world's various corners. This was why she had used a commune as a doorway to the past. And now, Kellis. He had rewritten the world down to its very foundations, a world where all were slaves of repetition, of the twin darknesses of custom and appetite, a world where beliefs served the powerful instead of the true. The old Esmanette would be astounded, even outraged, but she would come to believe, eventually. The world indeed held miracles, though only for those who dared abandon old hopes. Breathing deeply, Esmanette untied the leather string about the first scroll. Like the third analytic, the sagas were one of those works familiar even to illiterate caste menials such as herself. She found it strange recalling her impressions of such things before a commune or Kellis. The ancient North, she knew, had always seemed weighty and profound, a phrase with a palpable, skin-prickling air. It lay like cold lead among the other names she knew, a marker of loss, hubris, and the implacable judgment of ages. She knew of the no-god, the apocalypse, the ordeal, but they were little more than curiosities. The ancient North was a place, something she could point to, and for whatever reason, everyone had agreed that it was one of those words, enunciations that, like Skilvendi or Tusk, bore the whiff of overarching doom. The sagas had been little more than a rumor attached to that word. Books, to be certain, were frightful things, but in the way of snakes to city dwellers, something safely ignored. Those times a commune mentioned the sagas, he did so only to dismiss or disparage. For a mandate schoolman, he said, they were like pearls strung across a corpse. He spoke of the apocalypse and the no-god the way others described running arguments with their relatives, with a thoughtless, first-hand immediacy, and in terms and tones that would often set her hair on end. With a commune, the ancient North, which for all its dread had remained blank and obdurate, became something intricate and encompassing, a frame for what seemed an inexhaustible litany of extinguished hopes. By comparison, the sagas had come to seem something foolish, perhaps even criminal. Those rare times she heard others mention them, she would smile inwardly and scoff. What could they know of these things, even those who could read? But as much as she had learned about the apocalypse, the fact remained that she knew nothing of the sagas themselves. The moment she gingerly unrolled the first section of scroll, that ignorance struck her with a curious force of undone deceptions. Despite the title, she was surprised to discover that the sagas consisted of a number of different works written by a number of different authors, though only two, Hiorthau and Nau-Genor, were named. There were 9 sagas in total, starting with the Kelmariad. Some, she would later discover, were verse epics, while others were prose chronicles. She chided herself for her surprise. Once again, she'd found complexity where she had expected simplicity. Was that not always the way? She had no idea where Kellis had obtained the scroll, but it was very old, and as much painted as inked, the prize of some dead scholar's library. The parchment was uterine, soft and unmottled. Both the style of the script and the diction and tone of the translator's dedicatory seemed bent to the sensibilities of some other kind of reader. For the first time, she found herself appreciating the fact that this history was itself historical. For some reason, she had never considered that writings could be part of what they were about. They always seemed to hang outside the world they depicted. It was strange. Here she lay curled on her marriage bed, her head propped on silk-threaded pillows, the scroll at a lazy angle before her. But when she read the opening invocation, "Rage, goddess, sing of your flight, from our fathers and our sons. Away, goddess, secret your divinity, from the conceit that makes kings of fools, from the scrutiny that makes corpses of souls. Mouths open, arms thrown wide, we beseech thee, sing us the end of your song. Everything about her, the wrought canopy, the dim grottos behind the screens, the hanging panels, disappeared. Reading, she realized, resituated. It made gauze of what was immediate, and allowed what was ancient and far away to rise into view. It unpinned here from the senses, and made it everywhere. It released now from the cage of the present, and lent it the aspect of eternity. Infected by a kind of floating wonder, she fell into the first of the sagas. She found the going both difficult and curiously erotic, as though, aside from the masturbatory solitude of reading, her struggle to accommodate the writer's ancient assumptions was something too intimate not to be carnal. The realization that the Kalmariad was actually the history of Anassarimber Kelmomus stole her breath and sparked her first premonition of dread. This was not only the story of Achaemenid's dreams, it was also the story of Kellis's blood. These times and places, she realized, were neither so ancient nor so far away as she might have wished. She gathered that the dynasty of Anassarimber was old and venerable, even in those days of far antiquity. In fact, the verses were replete with references to times and places. The Khand Yoke, the god-kings of Umarau, the rape of Omandalia, of which she knew nothing. For some reason, she had always thought of the first apocalypse as the beginning of history rather than the end of one. Once again, what had been blank and monolithic became encompassing, a mansion with many rooms. The birth of Kelmomus II had been as ill-starred as any birth could be. He was the twin of a stillborn brother named Huarmomus. The line, "His rosy wail could not stir his brother's blue slumber," made her restless with thoughts of Serwe and Moengus. And the way the poet used this macabre image to explain the High King's flint-hearted brilliance made her inexplicably anxious. Huarmomus, the poet insisted, ever stalked his brother's side, chilling his heart even as he quickened his intellect. Grim kinsman, frosting the breath of his every counsel, dark reflection, even the night chieftains bundle their cloaks when they catch your glint in their lord's eye. After this, the strange intensity that had nagged everything, from the mere thought of reading the sagas to the weight of the scrolls in her palm, took on the character of a compulsion. It was as if something, a second voice, whispered beneath what she read. Once, she even bolted from the bed and pressed her ear to the embroidered canvas walls. She enjoyed stories as much as anyone. She knew what it was to hang in suspense, to feel the tug of some almost grasped conclusion. But this was different. Whatever it was she thought she heard, it spoke not to some climactic twist, nor even to some penetrating illumination. It spoke to her, the way a person might. The next 4 days would be haggard, jealousy, murder, rage, and doom before all. The first apocalypse engulfed her. She quickly realized that, despite all her discussions with Achaemenid, her understanding of the old wars was merely episodic. The Kelmariad struck them into the shape of the Cunayoric High King's life, beginning with the dire warnings of his arcane counselor, Seswatha, and culminating with his death on the Eleniot fields. In many ways, it began as a common tale. Seswatha was the doomsayer, the only one who could correctly read the gathering signs. Kelmomus, meanwhile, was the arrogant king, the one who could see only what was self-serving. Apparently, long before, a fugitive Gnostic school called the Mengika had somehow pierced the ancient glamour the non-men Kuya had used to conceal Min Uroikos, the legendary stronghold of the Inkoroi. While Kelmomus was still a young man, emissaries of Nilgikas, the non-man king of Ishterabinth, approached Seswatha, the High King's childhood friend and vizier. The non-men worried that the Inkoroi, whom they had driven to the four corners of the world in the days of Kujara Kinmoy, had found their way back to Min Uroikos, and with the Mengika had renewed their harrowing studies. They told him of the rumors they had extracted from their long-dead captives. They told him of the No-God. So Seswatha began his long argument, his attempt to convince the ancient Norserai kings of the impending apocalypse. Though none of the sagas took Seswatha as its subject, he surfaced and resurfaced throughout, like something continually kicked up in the rolling flotsam of events. In the Kelmariad, he was a principal, the stalwart of a mighty and inconstant king. The same was true of the Kaiutiad, the verse epic of Kelmomis's youngest and most glorious son, now Kaiuti, where Seswatha was both teacher and surrogate father. In the Book of Generals, the prose inventory of events following now Kaiuti's death, his was the most powerful and most resented voice in council after council. In the Trisiad, the verse account of Trice's destruction, he was a shining beacon on the parapets, clawing dragons from the sky with sorcerous light. In the Aemnoriad, he was the scheming foreigner, who, for all his grand declarations, fled on the eve of the No-God's approach. In the Annal Exursa, he was hope incarnate, the raised shield of High King Kundral III. In the Annal Sakarpa, he was a lunatic refugee, cast out after cursing King Huruth V for not fleeing to Metsonk with the Koray horde. And in the Anaxiad, the grand and tragic saga of Kyrenius's fall, he was nothing less than the world's savior, the bearer of the Heron Spear. Hated or adored, Seswatha was the pin in the Navigator's bowl, the true hero of the sagas, though not one cycle or chronicle acknowledged him as such. And each time Esmanet encountered some variant of his name, she would clutch her breast and think, Akamian. It was no small thing to read of war, let alone apocalypse. No matter how pressing her daily routine, images from the sagas dogged her soul's eye. Shrank, armored, and mandibles freshly cut from their victims, the burning library of Sauglish and the thousands who'd sought refuge within her hallowed halls, the wall of the dead, the cloak of corpses draped about the seaward ramparts of Dagliash, foul Golgotharoth, her golden horns curving mountainous into dark skies, and the No-God, Tsuruma, a great winding tower of black wind. War and more war. Enough to engulf every city, every hearth, to sweep up all innocence, even the unborn, into its merciless jaws. The thought that Akamian continually lived these things oppressed her with an evasive, even cringing sense of guilt. Each night, he saw the horizon move with hordes of Shrank. He shrank beneath a pitch of dragons swooping from black-bellied clouds. Each night, he witnessed Trice, the Holy Mother of Cities, washed in the blood of her bewildered children. Each night he literally relived the No-God's dread awakening. He actually heard the mother's wail over their stillborn sons. Absurdly, this made her think of his dead mule, Daybreak. She had never understood, not truly, how much weight that name must have possessed for him. Such poignant hope. And this, she realized with no little horror, meant that she'd never understood Akamian himself. Not truly. To be used night after night, to be debased by hungers vast, ancient, and rutting, how could a whore fail to see the outrage that had been heaped upon his soul? You are my morning, Esme, my dawn light. What could it mean? For a man who lived and relived the ruin of all, what could it mean to awake to her touch, to her face? Where had he found the courage, the trust? I was his mourning. Esmanet felt it then, overpowering her, and in the strange fashion of moving souls, she struggled to ward it away. But it was too late. For what seemed the first time, she understood. His pointless urgency, his desperation to be believed, his haggard love, his short-winded compassion, shadows of the apocalypse all. To witness the dissolution of nations, to be stripped night after night of everything cherished, everything fair, the miracle was that he still loved, that he still recognized mercy, pity. How could she not think him strong? She understood, and it terrified her, for it was a thing too near to love. That night she dreamed that she floated over the deeps, stranded in the heart of some nameless sea. Terror pulled at her, like rocks bound about her ankles. But when she peered down, she could only see shadows in the blackening water beyond her feet. They bewitched her with their almost clarity, ponderous and vast, coiling about enormities. Though at first she refused to countenance it, her eyes gradually adjusted, and the monstrous forms became more and more distinct. Never had she felt so small, so exposed. The entire sea, beyond all the drowned horizons, lay placid and sun-green above black boiling deeps. Flexing movement, great milky eyes, palisades of translucent teeth. And there, pale and naked, floating like a tuft through the midst of it, a Commian. His arm waved dead in the current. Suddenly she was gasping and shaking in Kellis's perfumed embrace. He shushed her, stroked hair from her eyes, explained that it was all a nightmare. The desperation with which she held him shocked her. "I don't want to share you," she whispered, kissing the soft curls about his neck. "Nor I you," he said. She had never told him about a Commian, about their kiss that horrid night with Proyas and Zynemus, but it was not a secret between them, merely something unspoken. She had spent hours pondering his silence, and hours more cursing her own. Why, when Kellis had so consistently coaxed her every weakness from her, would he pass over this one in silence? But she dared not ask, especially not while laboring through the sagas. She could see it all so clearly now, the derelict cities, the smoking temples, the strings of dead that marked the slave roads to Golgotharoth. She followed the non-men erratics as they rode across the countryside hunting survivors. She saw the Srank digging up the stillborn and burning them on raised pyres. She watched it all from afar, more than 2,000 years too late. Never had she read anything so dark, so despairing, or so glorious. It seemed poison had been poured into Wonder's own decanter. This, she thought time and again, is his night. And though she tried to beat the words from her heart, they rose nonetheless, as cold as accusatory truth, as relentless as earned affliction. I was his mourning. One evening, shortly before completing the last of the cantos, she happened upon a Commian sitting oblivious on a tilted table of stone, soaking his feet in the green of the Nazimel River. A gladness of heart struck her, so sudden and so simple that she actually gasped. Her dismay was equally abrupt and far more complicated. She would have called out something like, "Killing the river now, are we?" For the man was nothing, if not ripe. She would have plopped her bum alongside him, traded lame jokes as they swished the water together. She would have quietly crept up behind him and shouted, "Look out!" in his ear. But now, just watching him seemed menacing. It was his fault for dying! If only he had stayed! If only Zynemus had said nothing of the library! If only her hand hadn't lingered in Kellis's lap! She felt his heart hush for terror. "Esme," he had said the night of his return from the dead. "It's me. Me." Beyond him, a band of Thunieri stripped nude, hopping as they struggled with their leggings. One of them ran howling, vaulted from a boulder into the burnished water. On the far shore where the water trilled across gravel shallows, several women, slaves laundering clothes, held their sides in laughter. Out where the shade of the catalpa trees reached across the water, the Thunieri broke the surface with a triumphant roar. Either ignoring the ruckus or insensible to it, a Commian leaned forward to scoop water into his palms. He splashed it across his face, grimaced, and blinked. Sunlight winked from the black curls of his beard. As though stunned, he stared into the waters, opening and shutting his eyes. She had the abrupt sensation of awakening, as if the past months had been naught but one of those devious nightmares that somehow cloaked acts of horror in thoughtless normality. She had never succumbed to Kellis. She had never repudiated a Commian. And she could call out, "Akka!" But it was no dream. Kellis ran his warm palm from her shoulder to her breast, and she gasped as he pinched her nipple. Then his hand swept down across her belly to the bone-smooth curve of her hip, along her outer thigh, then around, inside. She raised and spread her legs, and Akka wept, clawed his beard in horror and disbelief. "Esme!" he cried. He shrieked. "Esme, please! It's me! It's me! I'm alive!" Tears had blurred him into the sepia glare. She stood upon stony earth, and yet she plummeted, for she understood that her betrayal was without bottom, that her infidelity was without compare. The buzzing thoughts, the flush through face and thighs that afternoon when Kellis had accidentally brushed her breast, the hammering heart, the stinging breath, that night when Kellis had hardened against the touch of her hand, the secret looks, the wanton reveries, the wonder of awakening beside him, the slick warmth between her legs when all was desert dry, the rapture of taking him inside her knees, her womb, her heart, the strength of him bearing into her, the moans, the horror in a Commian's eyes. Who was that base and treacherous woman? For Esmonette knew she could never do such a thing. She simply wasn't capable, not to Akka, not him. Then she recalled her daughter, somewhere out there across the seas, sold into slavery. Reaching back to hook a sandal, a Commian pulled a foot from the water. He hunched against his knee, began lacing the leather strings. There was resignation in his manner, and tragedy, too, as though his acts were both aimless and irresistible. Breathless, her hands pressed to her belly, Esmonette stole away. She abandoned him by the river, a sole survivor of the apocalypse, a man grieving his single trust, his one beauty, mourning the whore, Esmonette. That night, she returned to the sagas, slack of limb and heart. She wept when she finished the final canto. The pyres gutted, the towers fallen and black, the foemen glutted, our glory slung cross his back. The world's keel broken, our blood thinner than our tears, the story spoken, as though the dead possessed ears. She wept, and she whispered, "Akka," for she was his world, and all lay in ruin. "Akka, Akka, please." According to non-man legend, the falling of the Inku Haloinas, the Ark of the Skies, had cracked the world's mantle, striking wedges into the endless dark. Saswatha now knew this legend to be true. With now Keyuti at his side, a Commian crouched in the darkness, peering across the yawning fall before them. For days they had groped through the black, too terrified to dare any light. At times it seemed they climbed through blackened lungs, so choked and multitudinous were the tunnels. Their elbows bled from crawling on their bellies. During the years of the great investiture, the Srank had burrowed out from Golgotharoth, far beneath the armies camped across the surrounding plains. When the siege was broken, the consult had forgotten the mines, thinking themselves invincible. And why would they not? The ordeal, the holy war called by Anasarimber Kelmomus against Golgotharoth, had dissolved in acrimony and cannibal pride. And the unholy advent was near, so very near. Who would dare what Seswatha and the High King's youngest son now dared? "Please, wake up." "What is it?" now Keyuti murmured. "A postern of some kind?" Lying prone, they stared over the lip of an upturned ledge across what could only be a mighty chasm. Entire mountains seemed to hang about them, cliff from towering cliff, plummet from plummet, dropping down into blackness, reaching up to pinch a great curved plain of gold. It loomed above them, impossibly immense, wrought with never-ending strings of text and panels, each as broad as a war galley's sail, engraved with alien figures warring in relief. The lights from below cast a gleaming filigree across its expanse. They looked upon the dread ark itself, Seswatha knew, rammed deep into the sockets of the earth. They had reached the deepest pits of Golgotharoth. Below their vantage, across some hundred lengths of cavernous space, there was a door set perpendicular to the fall. Stonework had been raised beneath it, a platform with two immense braziers whose fires had blackened the ark's surface where it bowed above them. A network of landings and stairs twined into the black obscurity below. Partially screened by curtains of fire, several shrank, reclined, and rutted on the gate's threshold. Yammering squeals rang through the emptiness.
Akka, what should we do?
Seswatha whispered. The exercise of sorcery couldn't be risked, not here, where the slightest bruise would be sure to draw the Mengika. His mere presence was fatal. With characteristic decisiveness, now Keyuti had already started stripping his bronze armor. Akamian watched the profile of his face, struck by the contrast between his pitch-blackened skin and the blonde of his thickening beard. There was determination in his eyes, but it was born of desperation, not the zest and confidence that had made him such a miraculous leader of men. Akamian turned away, unable to bear the falsehoods he had told him.
"This is madness," he murmured.
"But she's here," the warrior hissed.
"You said yourself."
Wearing only his hide kilt, now Keyuti stood and ran his hands across the immediate stone faces. Then, clutching thin lips of rock, he hauled himself over the abyss. His heart in his throat, Seswatha watched him edge out across the gaping spaces, his back and calves shining with exertion and sweat.
Something, a shadow, above him.
"Akka, you're dreaming!" A spark of light, frail and glaring.
"Please!"
At first, she seemed an apparition before him, a glowing mist suspended in void, but as he blinked, he saw her lines drawn off into darkness, the lantern illuminating her oval face.
"Esme," he croaked.
She knelt beside his bed, leaning over him. His thoughts reeled.
What was the time?
Why hadn't his wards awakened him? The horror of Golgotharoth still tingled through his sweaty limbs. She had been crying. He could see that. He raised his hands, sheepish with slumber, but she pulled away from his instinctive embrace. He remembered Kellis.
"Esme."
Then softer.
"What is it?"
I just need you to know."
Suddenly, his throat ached. He glimpsed her breasts, like smoke beneath the sheer fabric of her shift.
"What?"
Her face crumpled, then recomposed.
"That you are strong."
She fled, and once again, all was dark and absolute. It flew at night, wary of the ground below. It beat its way higher and higher until the air became needles and tears fractured the million-starred void. Then it coasted, wings wide and scooping. Urgency did not come easily to such an ancient intellect. It pondered in the manner of its race, though its thought balked at the limits of its synthese frame. Millennia had passed since last it had warred across such a Benjuka plate. The mandate vindicated, their children discovered, dragged into the light, the holy war reborn as an instrument of unknown machinations. That vermin could be so cunning. Mad the Skilvendi might be, but the testimony of events could not be denied. These Dunyane. The rushing air had grown warm, and the ground rose as though upon a swell. Trees and bracken sunned their backs beneath the cold moon. Slopes pitched and dropped, streams roped along dark and stony courses. The synthes wound over and through the shadowy landscape, unto the ends of Anathpania. Golgotharoth would not be pleased with this new disposition of pieces.
But the rules had changed. There were those who preferred clarity.